Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Jeremy. I'm one of the pastors here at Countryside Covenant. Thank you for being here today. And I have many flaws. Some of you have realized those flaws. Some of you have not yet because you have not gotten to know me that well. But yet, I have these flaws day in and day out, and yet somehow God's grace continues to find me. I am disobedient at times, choosing my will over God's will, and yet God's grace still finds a way to demonstrate that God is present with me. For those of you who have been here for a while, you have heard this before, but for those of you who are new, this is going to be new to you. And really, I'm just saying it's going to be new to you because really it's just a reminder to everybody else who's been here for a while that they've probably forgotten, and I'm just trying to give them a little bit of grace. Okay? When I was in high school, I sensed that God was calling me into youth ministry. I had one foot in the church. You know, I'd go to church every Sunday, I'd be at youth group every Wednesday. But man, I had another foot outside the door because sin was fun at the time. And so despite this one foot in the church, one foot outside the church, I still sensed that God was calling me to do ministry. And so I went away to college, majoring in youth ministry and communication arts because I needed a backup plan, of course, right? You know. So I did that, and then after I graduated, I joined the largest youth ministry in the world, the United States Army. And so I did that for 6 years, and I sensed that God was still using me. God showed up in miraculous ways. I was still working, volunteering in the church and the high school ministry, as my wife was as well. As I mentored high school boys, she mentored high school girls. And things were great. God showed up. God was faithful. But there was a sense that I needed to go back to seminary to pursue his call. But I was avoiding it. I was avoiding working in the church full time. Why? Because I didn't feel good enough to work in God's church. I looked at my life and I said, well, I have sin in my life and I have a habitual sin and I'm a terrible person. I'm looking at all these other people that are Christians in my church. I'm looking at these pastors and I'm like, man, they seem to have it all together. They're perfect. I would assume all pastors were perfect. Now, the first service, they chuckled a little bit because they realized that pastors are not perfect, but we kind of put pastors on a pedestal. And I did as well, and I just assumed they had it all together. They talked about their struggles from the pulpit. They talked about, oh, you know, I'm not perfect. And so I'm like, yeah, but you have a way better life than I do. You don't struggle with the same things I do. You have the same issues I do that you're struggling with, that I'm struggling with. It's not the same. I'm worse. And so I would compare myself to people all the time, especially other pastors. Now, not to make this a praise John sermon here, but John is a pretty incredible guy, and he was a little bit bashful this morning. He's the most humble person that he knows, and I was saying to the church at first service, and I'll say it to you, that you should be grateful and thankful that you have a pastor like John, because he is a man of integrity. He is consistently and constantly praying for all of you. He cares for you. He is a man of compassion and heart. He's a peacemaker. He's a peacekeeper. And we should be grateful to have a pastor like that leading this church. And sometimes he drives me crazy. And sometimes I compare my life to his, and I'm like, man, he's so holy, he's so righteous. You know, like, I'm still this flawed individual. And whenever we play the comparison game, it never works out well for us. So I don't know if any of you are struggling here in your life sometimes where you feel like, I just don't measure up to those other Christians, or I just don't measure up very well at all when I compare myself, either how I look or how I act, how I think, how I behave. My life doesn't reflect other people in the church. I would just say that God is going to still use you despite you. God is still using me despite myself. Why? Because I allowed him to use me despite me. And if I were to wait until I was perfect and had it all figured out, I would have never gone into ministry in the first place. So, here's what we're going to address this morning. As we heard Reba pray about these untruths that we believe about ourselves, as we'll hear from Ian Cunningham in a little bit after the sermon, a testimony of God's grace and work in his life, and the sermon that I have prepared, all of them are woven in together. Because that's how God works, because God is a good God. We're looking today at God's grace, and we're looking at the era of the patriarchs. And last week, Pastor John talked about the creation, Genesis 1 through 12, and now I'm looking at 12 through 50 in Genesis, which is a lot of chapters, so this is not going to be an expository sermon. I'm not going to get into the details of every single text, because that's a lot of chapters to cover, and I'd like to be done before this year ends. So this is an overview. Today we're looking at the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Those are the patriarchs, and we will see that in their lives, God's grace, God's mercy shows up constantly to work out God's will through their lives, and that their lives were filled with grace and filled with mercy, but they were also filled with strife, with heartache, with difficulties, with jealousy, with setbacks, with pain. And they experienced all those things, and God's grace and God's mercy still showed up in their lives and worked despite their shortcomings. When Abraham was 75 years old, God told him to go and leave this place. He was faithful. He was obedient. He left this place called Haran. He traveled to Egypt with his wife Sarah, or back then it was Sarai before God changed her name. And they set off. And we're going to see just a little bit of a repeating pattern with the patriarchs. Genesis 12, verses 10 through 13. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram, who's later Abraham, went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. And he was about to enter Egypt, and he said to his wife Sarah, "Oh, I know what a beautiful woman you are. You're so gorgeous, woman. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you." Now, gentlemen, if you are afraid of those around you, that they might kill you because of how gorgeous your bride is, and you tell your wife to say, "Just pretend that you're my sister," you won't have to worry about being killed by those other people. Because when you get home, your wife will do the job. Abraham is in fact treated well. He's been given all kinds of livestock and he's blessed. He's given a lot of stuff. But notice that he's kind of looking out for himself. He is concerned more for himself. You know, hey, if you say that you're my sister, I'll live. That's good. I don't know necessarily what will happen with you. Maybe it won't work out so great for you being in this land where people are willing to kill a man to have this woman. But maybe it won't work out so well. But if you say that you're my wife, then they're going to kill me. That's bad, right? So he's kind of looking out for himself. He's blessed. He's been given all kinds of stuff from Pharaoh. But then Pharaoh and his people realize that they have been deceived by Abraham. Abraham had lied to them. And there is a plague that breaks out, and they're like, "Hey, why'd you tell us she's your sister? Obviously she's not, and now you've caused all this problem." So they kick Abraham, they kick Sarah out of the land. They're like, "Go get out of here, we don't ever want to see you again." But there's Abraham, and there's Sarah. And then there is a note that she is still childless. Now this is of note. So after all these years of not being able to have a child and God promising Abraham that they will, in fact, Abraham will be a father of many nations, Sarai gets a great, brilliant idea in her head, and she says, "Hey, why don't you sleep with my servant Hagar and we can have a child through her, because maybe that's how it's supposed to happen." And so She does, and he does, and she gets pregnant, and Sarah is so jealous that she kicks this pregnant woman out of the house, out of the land. She's gonna go fend for yourself. She's out in the wilderness weeping bitterly, and an angel comes, comforts her, says, hey, you gotta go back. All right, Hagar has a child named Ishmael. Ishmael. Abraham was 86 years old when this happened. 13 years later, when Abraham was 99, God tells Abram that no, in fact, the child that I promised you, this lineage that I'm going to work through you, is actually going to be born by your wife, Sarah. So let's hear Abraham's response. Genesis 17, verses 17 through 22. Abraham fell face down. He laughed and he said to himself, will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? And Abraham said to God, if only Ishmael might live under your blessing. Then God said, yes, but your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call him Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you, and I will surely bless him. I will make him fruitful and greatly increase his numbers. He will be the father of 12 rulers, and I will make him into a great nation. But my covenant, I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you by this time next year. Now, this takes place, and before this even takes place, wouldn't you know, I was going somewhere else. I was too far ahead of the story, all right? But in here, we've got a little bit of grudges, a little bit of deceit, a little bit of shady action going around, you know, concubine, slave, having another kid, 13 years later, having another son. And you've got Isaac and you've got Ishmael. Ishmael is the firstborn. Isaac is the secondborn. And yet the covenant promise is going to go with the younger over the older. Abraham, after having Isaac, the son that he's been waiting for, this promised one, for so long, God says, look, if you really trust me, you're going to have to give him back to me. So God tells Abraham to go and sacrifice his own son so that we will see just how faithful Abraham is. And so right before Isaac is about to be killed, God intervenes once again, spares his child. Abraham is given a sacrifice to sacrifice, and Isaac's life is spared. Now, as a child, if you are talking and walking with your father up a mountain to do a sacrifice, and you're able to have a conversation of, hey, Dad, where's the sacrifice animal? Hey, what's going on? Hey, well, I'm being tied down. Hey, what's... If you're old enough to have those kind of conversations, and you remember that your father is about to kill you, that's probably going to stick with you for a little bit in your mind, would it not? A little bit of trauma. Well, much later, Isaac, when he's around 40 years old, he meets Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. You see a pattern emerging here. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. And the babies jostled each other within her. She said, why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, there are two nations in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. The older will serve the younger. How to write the first time? I don't know. But another pattern emerges. So the boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter and a man of the open country, while Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebecca loved Jacob. The parents playing favorites with their children. Not really going to do much for their self-esteem, probably. And so we still hear this promise that God is going to establish not just the covenant, the promise, but that the younger is going to be in charge and the older is going to serve the younger. Jacob, which actually means deceiver, goes and he tricks his brother Esau into selling his birthright to him over some lentil soup. Because Esau despised his birthright. He probably thought, well, my dad loves me more anyway, so I'm just going to get the birthright regardless. Well, wouldn't you know that even before any of this took place with being deceived and these sons, wouldn't you know that Isaac happened to have been traveling. And it says in Genesis chapter 26, verse 7, that when the men of that place asked him about his wife, wouldn't you know he said, she's my sister? Because he was afraid to say, she is my wife. He thought, the men in this place might kill me on account of Rebecca. Because why? She is ugly. Because she's beautiful. Wouldn't you know, like father, like son. So anyway, you have Jacob and Esau. Jacob tricks Esau into giving his birthright. Jacob and his mom, who loves him more than his brother Esau, scheme together. They decide to deceive Isaac, the father, into blessing him instead of his brother Esau. So when Esau finds out that both his birthright are gone and his blessing is gone, he is furious. His mom says, hey, Jacob, you better get out of here because your brother is going to kill you. The older will serve the younger. Well, much later, Jacob, he goes and he prays and he finds this woman that he falls in love with. He falls in love with this woman named Rachel. He is pleased. His heart is just longing for this woman. He says, oh, she's so beautiful. This is going to be my wife. And so he goes to Laban and the father, and he says, I want to marry your daughter. And he's like, okay, fine. Serve me for 7 years, and I will give her to you. He's like, all right, bet. I will do this. And so he does. And he goes, and he marries this woman. And the next morning, he realizes it's not Rachel. It's the older sister, Leah. And he's like, Laban, like, what's going on, man? Why'd you do this to me? And his response is, it's our custom that the older does not lose its right, her right, his right. It's not right to take the younger before the older. Do you see the pattern switched? Now Jacob is the one deceived. Well, he's like, well, great, now I got this woman, Leah, and I don't even really want to be with her. And Laban's like, fine. Serve me for 7 more years, and you can have Rachel too. But he's like, but wait, there's more. No. So Jacob goes and he does this, but he's like, yeah, I'm going to get back to Laban. I'm going to get back at him. So he takes the goats and he herds and he puts stripes on them, and he ends up like taking a ton of the livestock back with him, deceiving Laban. Well, wouldn't you know, Jacob ends up having 12 sons. And he has a favorite too, named Joseph. And wouldn't you know that the brothers are jealous of that too? You remember VeggieTales, right? Joseph in the coat of the, what was it? The Technicolor suit, coat. Yeah, that one. So the brothers are jealous of their younger brother because the younger brother says, hey, guess what? All of you are going to bow down and worship me someday. And they're like, oh, this is enough. We've had enough of this. What is it? That's what your dad said. Hey, that's what your dad's dad said. Well, Joseph is taken out and he's going to be murdered by his brothers. They have a change of heart, though. Instead of throwing him into a pit and leaving him for dead, they sell him into slavery. They go back and they deceive their father, Jacob, that his youngest son, his favorite son, is dead, eaten by a wild animal. Meanwhile, Joseph is taken into slavery into Egypt. Another one going back to Egypt. And then he's thrown in prison, he's raised up again, and now he's the second most powerful person in all of Egypt. And wouldn't you know, there was a famine, and they had to come to Egypt. And wouldn't you know, Joseph is there ready to deceive his brothers yet again, not once, twice. Then he reveals himself to them, and all is made well again, until the whole slavery thing for 400 years takes over, and Moses is born. Okay, so the patterns emerge. The patterns emerge. Childlessness, deceit of the fathers, the older serving the youngers. Look, I'm telling you, our families of origin have a huge impact on our lives. Good or bad, they have a tremendous play on how we live our lives, how we understand life, how we look at life. Family dynamics are extremely powerful, and we see how this happens in the dysfunction of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, the deceptions, the lies, the heartache, the strife, and yet God's grace, God's mercy still shows up, and somehow still his plan happens the way it needs to happen. In fact, Joseph has this revelation. He says, "Brothers, what you intended for evil, God intended for good." There's a reason why people turn to to drugs. There's a reason why people turn to gangs. There's a reason why people turn to promiscuity. There's a reason why people are stuck in generational poverty. There's reasons why we do the things we do, because that we are grown up, or we are only shown or given these examples to live by, and it carries with us whether we like it or not. But yet God is still gracious and merciful, and he wants to break those chains that have held many of us back. He wants to break the chains. He wants to set us free. So will we let him? Will we live in the self-defeat, the way in which we talk to ourselves saying, "I am not good enough. God can't possibly use me"? Or are we going to think the truth, saying, "Well, look, if God was able to work in and through these patriarch people who screwed up royally over and over again, and yet God's grace still worked, are we willing to submit to God's will and allow his leading in our life?" Don't play the comparison game, and don't wait until you are perfect and have it all figured out before you ask God to use you. He's going to use you despite you. And it doesn't give us a license to continue just living however we want to live with no repercussions because God's grace and his forgiveness abounds. Well, that's true. But God calls us to live righteously. He calls us to live holy lives because it's really for our benefit. It's to keep us from experiencing these heartaches, these trials that we could just simply avoid if we were willing to align our lives with his. Don't wait until you have it all figured out. Don't wait until you are perfect before you start responding to God's call. Or none of us are going to do anything. Know that God is going to work through you despite you. In a moment, and I said that first service too, and it's like, in a moment, no, actually right now, I'm going to invite Ian Cunningham up. He's from Omega House, and he's going to share with us a little bit of his testimony about how God brought him through some circumstances and continues using him today. So Ian, thank you and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, church. Such a privilege to be here. I'm in the Omega Project, and I also serve there as well. I grew up in a really violent home. It was very dysfunctional. So I chose to walk a more difficult path. I had a hard time navigating my teens and 20s. I fell into drug and alcohol addiction. I was wayward. I lived a prodigal lifestyle. And after a while, I was alone, I was isolated, I pushed everybody away, I was angry at the cards I had been dealt in my life, and no one was going to hurt me ever again, and I had that attitude, and it didn't get me anywhere, you know. 10 years in of living however I wanted to feel, rebelling against everyone, living in addiction, freedom, it got me nowhere. It got me close to death. And God showed me how close to death I was, and I became afraid. And I started going to church and got saved. I was 26 years old, and God called me at the worst moment in my life. I was in drug addiction, and talk about unqualified, you know, how great God is that he would use somebody like me. He's like, you're gonna be a pastor. And I'm like, my life is a disaster, you know? Like, what do you mean? It didn't make any sense at all. And so he led me to a Christian program to address my addiction. And I went through there for a couple of years. I worked there. And I went to Bible college in Massachusetts. And I got a bachelor's degree in pastoral ministry. I met the person that I would marry. I met my wife. And I got a job right out of Bible college in a big church in Connecticut as a media director. And I thought I was good. My life was going to be okay. All the pain I experienced was behind me. My life was going to be smooth sailing. Everything was going to be good. And I was completely wrong. About a year into ministry, my wife became mentally ill, severely mentally ill. I believe it was schizophrenia. She took off. She did some unsavory things. And she was just falling apart before my eyes. And I tried to get her help, tried to get her into a couple programs, but she just couldn't surrender her life to God. And she ended up taking her life. This was about a year ago. So I was shell-shocked. I didn't know what to do. I was like, I came all this way for my wife to kill herself? Really? You know, like what am I supposed to do now, you know? I became widowed in my 30s, you know? Like, this is my life, really? And, you know, most people would check out, you know, hey, look, I'm going to check out. I got a good excuse to check out for the rest of my life. And I couldn't do that. I knew God was good. I knew God. I know God is good. I know he is. And something good is going to come out of my life. I don't care how long it takes. Something good is going to come out of my life. And I've never felt closer to God than I've ever felt in my entire life. I have this fellowship with Jesus. It says in Isaiah, he's a man acquainted with sorrow, you know? And I have that fellowship with him. I really do. He carried me in his arms. You know, how could I not believe in God, you know? How could I not, you know? For God to walk with me personally, like to carry me through that, and he brought me here. He brought me here, and thank God, that's God's grace, you know. I could have been buried in ministry. I could have put my head down. I could have walked away from the church. I could have did whatever I wanted to do, really. And he brought me to Kansas. He brought me to the Omega Project. Pastor Case just... what an example. He really shows the love of God. And he was like, just chill out. Just relax. Form relationships. Live in community. Don't isolate. You know? And gave me the space to do that. And it was wonderful. And he really walked with me through the grief of losing my wife, which is... difficult. It was really difficult. And the betrayal on top of that, I hated her and loved her at the same time, and losing her that way all at the same time. But he walked with me through it. It's been 13 months. I work there now. I'm serving the Lord still. You know, I don't care what happens in my life. I'm still going to serve God. I really don't. this ministry is such a blessing. The people that come in, some of them have never heard the gospel. And he's helping to change the community one person at a time. And he depends on the church. He depends on support from the community, money, financially, donations. And this church blesses this ministry. They've opened it up for us to have graduations. I know there's a relationship there already, so thank you. If you want to learn more about the ministry, we're offering small groups now. We're doing one-day retreats in the church. We really want to partner with the church. Because there's a lot of things in this ministry that I didn't learn in the church. I didn't even learn in Bible college. Some really practical things that we all deal with universally. Unforgiveness, bitterness, many things that we all deal with. And he breaks it down in a practical, biblical way, which is important. And that's available. Let your pastor know if you want to do that. And we're taking donations. There's a table right outside the door. He has books for sale. Even if you want to chat, you're more than welcome to. So thank you for the opportunity. God is good. Amen.
Thanks again. And just like both Ian and I have said, you don't have to be called into full-time vocational ministry. All of you have a place in which the community that you serve that is probably more important than what us on staff or other pastors do. We're here to equip you to go do the work. So God is using you in all of your circles of spheres, spheres of circles and spheres and rectangles, and I don't know what I was going to say. But God is using you, and he is calling you to work in those areas in which you work and where you serve, where you go to school. Let's pray. Jesus, thanks for, again, your blessing over this time. Thanks for Ian and his testimony, and God, for the work that you're continuing to do in his life. Thanks for Pastor Case and for the ministry of the Mega Project and Live Free Ministries, and for this place right here in McPherson that we can partner with as well and ask a blessing over them and for all of us in our congregation. God, help us to believe the truth about how you view us, and let us recognize the lies that we believe about ourselves. So, Christ, we love you and we praise you. Amen.